Welcome to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Michael W. Dean of the Freedom Fiends cooks up a very special blend of liberty, guns, sex, rock and roll, drugs, and thriving in spite of the state in an increasingly worrying world. All with a rotating cast of nifty guests who are also up in the middle of the night.
Anarchy Gumbo is proudly syndicated by Alterati.com and the Liberty Radio Network. Welcome to another episode of the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. This is Michael W. Dean, just woken up from a nap, drinking coffee and not Red Bull to try to wake up. And today our guest is Davi Barker, the Muslim agorist. How you doing, Davi?
I'm good. This is Davi Barker, just home from a bike ride.
How's it going? Now I'm getting a little bit intermittent, like I can hear fans in your room and then not hear them, or like a blowing sound. You there?
Yeah, just turning off the... It comes on by itself, but I just turned it off.
And we leave this in because we are a teaching hospital here at the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast, and one of my goals personally, I don't really have any huge goals. One of my goals is just to spread the idea of liberty, and the other goal is to spread the idea of how to improve your audio and video media. So turn off the fans, people. So, Davi, how you doing, man?
I'm good. It's good to hear your voice. I don't hear it every day, but
you hear it every day. What am I in your dreams?
It's an episode of your show since we met. Yeah.
Wow. But you didn't have a dream that you took a cat to a bar and had it dance with people and sing with you like my wife did today, did you?
No, I've never had that particular dream, no.
I was really amused and entertained. First of all, because she doesn't go to bars. Secondly, because our cat, when someone comes to the, you know, when the mailman comes to the door, the cats hide for about 10 minutes. When, like, a workman comes in the house, the cats hide till about an hour after he's gone. And if you took these cats to a bar, they would run to the warmest, darkest place in the basement and stay there for days.
Yeah.
But they were dancing with people.
We took our cat on a road trip to L.A. It's about a six-hour drive, and he totally freaked out. And once we got there, he hid under the bed for a few hours, but then it was just like home.
Yeah, two of our cats are kind of pussies. We, pun intended, we took a road trip from L.A. to Wyoming that was 3 days with two overnight stays in no-tell motels. And two of them were like kind of harmed by it to the point where I think they're still recovering 3 years later, and one of them just kind of slept through a lot of it.
Yeah. What are your cats' names?
The older lady who's 13 is Charlie, the tortoiseshell one. And she is really, really mellow and she purrs incredibly loud and snores sometimes when she sleeps to the point where it'll wake you up if you're in the room and you have to get up and pet her so she stops snoring and starts purring. She's an indoor-outdoor cat. She hangs out in the backyard and looks at squirrels. She doesn't chase them anymore. She did when she was younger. She used to bring me dead things, eviscerated gifts. The younger two, which we call the Squittens, are about 5 years old. They are litter mates, part Maine Coon. Fuzzy is the gray and white one that's really fuzzy. And Peanut is his brother that's white with yellow spots, yellow, and looks exactly like Taran Lupo's cat.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have one cat. He's about 3 years old. His name is Fiasco. He's a solitary indoor cat because he's sick. But he's just a lap cat. He can't get enough attention.
He's always sick or he's getting better?
Yeah, he has FIV, which is essentially feline AIDS. HIV. Yeah. And so we adopted him for that reason. And he can't, you know, he has to live alone and he has to live inside. But if we keep him healthy, he should live out a normal life. So
nice. So it's the kitty hospice, but long term.
Yeah.
Cool.
An assisted feline living facility.
Where do you live? And are you married or do you live alone or what do you do?
Yeah, I'm married. I live in Fremont, California.
Really?
Which is a suburb of Oakland, I guess.
Yes, I'm familiar with its work. I lived in San Francisco and Berkeley.
Yeah, we're right by Berkeley.
Yeah, it's like one or two BART stops away, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And what do you do? What's that? Go ahead.
You got anything pressing you want to talk about? I kind of want to talk about music.
Oh, yeah. I want to make fun of you for for your and compliment you at the same time, and then talk for the whole thing. Especially since I asked you about music the first time I interviewed you, and you kind of didn't talk about it. But was the interview I did with you about 6 months ago the first audio interview you ever did?
No, it was probably the third. I was on Radio Islam in Chicago like years ago, interviewed about cults or something. And then I was on Pork Therapy once before that. But yeah, I was not accustomed to radio interviews.
Yeah, because I set up an interview with you because I'm a fan of your work, even before you wrote the book. And, you know, you're like, what do you want to talk about? And I'm like, oh, probably, you know, Islam and the connect, you know, liberty connection with Islam. And you're like, great. And then we did the interview and you were really, really shy and I had to pry stuff out of you. And then I was like, well, let's talk about Islam. And you're like, I don't know if I should talk about that. And now you're writing books about it and doing interviews that make me sound like a sleepy stoner, even though I don't take drugs. I heard you the other day on the Fajita Power Hour. What's it called?
Fajita Fun Time. Yeah, that was a fun show.
Yeah. And I was like, whoa, most improved player, man. Listen to this guy talk. It was great.
Well, cool. Thanks for saying so.
So music, what do you want to talk about it?
Yeah, I think you might need to revoke my punk rock credentials.
Okay. I'm opening up the database now. Go ahead. Okay,
good. So when I used to play music, the actual genre was a thing called noise, but people don't really know what noise is. And so we would sort of like use punk rock for layman's. But after listening to like your show and like how much you talk about punk, I realized I was not really in a punk scene. And so I'm wondering, like, am I breaking the punk code by saying that I played punk rock? Like,
I don't know. Well, I don't know. In a sense, yes, but in a sense, no. There's no punk code. Henry Rollins, who's an incredible statist, but also incredibly brilliant. And I've tried to convert him to anarchism and he won't even return my emails. And we've communicated before and I've interviewed him and he's in my movie. But he said there's somewhere out there, there's some anarchy rules and I've been accused of breaking them. I've never actually seen them written down, but apparently I break them and
it's people, a social contract.
And people don't like it. It is. It's a social punk rock contract. So, you know, in the narrow purest sense of the word noise, and I am familiar with it and we could talk about noise bands. I'm not a fan, but I've seen a bunch of them. So even from the Bay Area, but in the purest sense of the word, that's not punk rock. In the purest sense of the word, punk rock is 4-4, mid to fast tempo or fast tempo, guitar, bass, drums, kind of screamed vocals, you know, gang unison vocals on the chorus with, you know, F the man kind of lyrics usually. That's pretty good thumbnail definition. There's things that...
We played a little bit of that, but we just identified as punk sometimes because we like the attitude of it. Like it was all a culture thing. It wasn't really about the specifics of the music. I mean, I played an electric guitar. You said something. You said something in a recent podcast about you know that you're into performance art because you bother to put some structure into it. And if you were just playing for yourself, you would just sort of like make weird noises on the guitar.
Yeah, I didn't say performance art, but you know, I was talking about the difference between being a pure artist, which is just pleasing yourself, and what I do, which is making stuff for people to consume.
Well, that was sort of like what we did.
I mean, you did the pure part. You were a pure noise artist.
I don't like the word pure because I don't like to get in a contest.
Yeah.
About how pure they are. But yeah, when we were on stage, it was about trying to figure out weird ways to use the guitar besides the typical way.
So, yeah.
Like, I used to play my guitar with a sword, literally. Like I'd hold it up like a violin and play it with a sword.
Well,
weird noises out of it that way.
I mean, there are actually some noise bands that got really popular that probably started out just doing it for themselves and not giving a darn. There was some stuff that was noise that I could hear the musicality in or hear the reason for people liking it. But I actually thought a lot of people liking it was and like being fervent about it and going to the shows and like collecting the T-shirts and nodding their head in a trance. I think a lot of it was Emperor's New Clothes. Like, oh, everyone says this is cool, so I'll convince myself it is.
Yeah, it was like the hipster's sort of illegitimate son of punk.
Yeah, couple bands that come to mind. One is a Japanese all-girl punk band called Angel in Heavy Syrup that I once saw at the 16th Note in San Francisco. Do you know them?
No, I've never heard of them.
There was a really popular band, noise band, that had a lot of records out from San Diego called The Locust. You know, that like as in a plague of.
Yeah, I gotcha.
Let's see. There was a band in kind of popular band in San Francisco called Subarachnoid Space.
That sounds really familiar. You know, this was so many years ago, I don't remember a lot of the details.
Yeah.
But I got into noise following a band called Crust, and then me and some friends put together a band called Discordia, and we played around with a band called Discordia and did some of the noise fests and stuff like that.
Yeah. Was Crust a Crust punk noise band or just a noise band?
It was kind of punk. I mean, like, they definitely had some rhythm some of the time, but their shows were like a circus act. Like, they would hook up Sesame Street toys to their amplifiers and use, like, Elmo's little rock guitar as an instrument in some of their songs and stuff. Just weird
stuff. So it did have a performance art aspect in it.
Yeah, it kind of had, like, a Insane Clown Posse kind of a following, too, where there were people that participated from the audience and stuff like that.
Yeah, because what I was asking about crust punk, there is a genre. There's a lot of European leftist anarchist political bands that would fit the crust punk genre, which is really aggressive, loud 4/4 punk rock that is not noise in structure. It's rock in structure, but the vocals are really distorted, like not the low thing of metal, like, you know, where they put it through an octave divider, but just actually now, just
these guys were kind of goofy. They were like primates in a way.
Okay. They called this stuff was called, I've heard it called dog cage rock. Cause it kind of the singers kind of look and sound like a, you know, German shepherd police dogs behind a cage trying to eat you and barking through the cage.
So maybe crust wasn't crust.
I don't think so, from what it sounds like. Crust is an actual genre or subgenre of punk rock. And then there's the granddaddy of noise rock. My band Bomb, when we were on Warner Brothers, our record was produced by Bill Laswell. Do you know his work?
No. I remember you mentioning him, though.
Yeah, he's a record producer, but he also has a couple bands. One, I think, was called White House, or maybe he just produced them, but another was called... God, what was it called? It had a saxophone player and the drummer from Napalm Death and him playing bass. And to write their songs, they would just write a really offensive phrase, like, you know, the vagina of a nun eviscerated by the eyes of the Lord or something like that. And then that would be the lyric to it. And they would write down how long the song was going to be, like a minute, 32 seconds. They'd all start playing and look at the clock and then stop when it stopped. God, what were they called? I'm going to have to look it up. I used to use their CD to clear out parties at my house when I wanted people to leave. But the problem was everybody would leave except like the two or three guys you really didn't want to leave, and they'd stay and dig it.
Yeah, we did that actually with some house parties, that we would come on after whatever band had booked the house party, and they would let us sort of like borrow their instruments long enough to clear the house.
Yeah. Yeah, Praxis is one of his bands, and Massacre... Painkiller was the band I was talking about. It was really weird. I saw them play in San Francisco at Slim's. Do you know the club Slim's?
No.
I don't know if it's still there, but it was owned by, it doesn't matter who it was owned by, some pop singer. But it held like 900 people, and it was one of those kind of like really tightly run ship clubs where, like, you know, all the personnel have little headsets on and can communicate to each other. And the bouncers are really big and pro and not drunk and do like to throw people out. And the sound system's great. And, you know, the average concert costs between $15 and $25, and it's a club. I saw Painkiller there, got on the guest list, but it was like $35 a ticket. It was 900 people there. They were turning people away at the door. And, like, everybody looked like they were in a trance, just like, oh, my God, this is so great. It was his band Praxis, actually. And I was just like, this is friggin' noise in the literal sense of the word, and you people are all sheep, and you don't really like this, and you're just here because everyone says it's cool. I was convinced of it.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say that I liked other noise bands.
It was just fun. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, this is why I say it had a kind of a hipster quality, because, like, it seems like in a lot of genres it's kind of cool to know people, And in the noise community, it was sort of cooler not to know people. Like, it was cooler to be like so aloof that you didn't care who they were. And you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that kind of attitude also is in.
Are you there? Did I lose you?
No, I'm here. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I was playing with knobs, trying to get you a little louder, but I'm going to keep it where it is. It's good. Yeah, there's something called stoner rock, too. Do you know what stoner rock is?
No.
There's kind of that same attitude you were talking about in stoner rock of, like, you know, it's cooler to not be a scenester and to, like, spend time in your practice space and in your bedroom playing video games or whatever. But it's a real serious genre. Like, a band that comes to mind is Cayuss, K-Y-U-S-S, Cayuss. They were from like Desert Hot Springs, California or something. It's incredibly loud, slow guitar, bass, drum, kind of doom rock, but even slower, with kind of stony lyrical, content. I don't know if you ever heard the band Blue Cheer from the '60s.
No,
they were kind of a progenitor of it. I'd say some Black Sabbath probably is too, but it's a new music genre, stoner rock.
Cool. Anyway,
noise. So I guess
I think I'm gonna voluntarily relinquish. I'm gonna opt out of the punk rock social contract, and I'm gonna just call I'm gonna say when I tell people that I used to play noise, and if they don't know what that is, then that's fine.
Well, you can't opt out of a social contract, but I have updated you in because a lot of people know this, but I am the keeper of the punk rock anarchy rules, and I solely maintain the central database. Of who's cool and who isn't and who is in and who's out. And you're still cool, but you're out because you said you are, which isn't usually how it works. Usually other people say you're out and then you're out, even if you think you're still in. But to go full circle with this, and I don't mean we're done talking about it. I'll talk about this till the cows come home. But the term punk rock, in a tight dictionary definition of it, noise rock is not punk rock, but in a loose definition of it, it is. I mean, I even go broader than that, and I use the term rock and roll for anything that has guitars and possibly has a 4/4 drum beat. Although did you guys have a beat?
Yeah, we had a guy. We didn't have a drum set, but we had a guy on a mixer kind of doing like a techno thing, and so he was our percussion and it had a beat.
Okay. Did you guys were you aware of or gave a crap about his beat? Did you try to play to it at all, or did you ignore it?
We did not bother to learn the rules.
Did you feel it?
We trusted him with that task, but he seemed to care very much about the beat.
Did he yell at you for not helping keep on it?
No, not really. He did change the beat occasionally, and we kind of learned where the changes were and stuff like that, but it was all intuitive.
Because I would say anything that has a beat and has power fits in the genre of the uber genre of rock and roll. I mean, I say rock and roll when I'm talking about the punk rock music I make, the hip hop music Nima makes, the punk rock hip hop music we make together. You know, Elvis Presley, the Rolling Stones, Black Sabbath, Lenny Kravitz, Pink Floyd. I call all of that rock and roll in a really, really broad sense. What's that?
Anything post electricity?
Yeah, that's a really good term. Although there is some acoustic blues music from the 1920s that I would call pre-rock and roll. Robert Johnson, basically, if you play any of his songs on the guitar, an electric guitar, and speed them up a tiny, tiny bit, they are literally like 50s rock and roll or something close to it.
Oh, cool.
But yeah, he was trying to get there without electricity because they didn't have they had electricity, but they didn't have electric guitars yet.
So can I say punk asterisk?
Yes, yes. You have an asterisk in your record, like all those athletes that took steroids.
My standing in the record is disputed.
Yes, yeah. Like when Homer Simpson gets his phone bill and he's like, Burkina Faso, disputed zone. Who calls all these crazy places? I just love the idea of disputed zone being a place on a phone bill because it kind of sounds like libertarian paradise to me.
Yeah, sure.
Although I think that disputed zones in Africa near Burkina Faso are probably not anything near libpair. Although people always say, well, if you want anarchy, move to a horrible warlordship that's secretly run by the United States government. Military. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So, I know that argument to me gives me hope because it means that they're running out of arguments.
I don't know, man. You think they'll ever run out of arguments?
Well, I mean, when the arguments are, what about the roads and why don't you move to Somalia? They obviously don't have an intellectual argument anymore, right?
Yeah. 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 And to bring up Islam, a lot of American idiots think, oh, well, Africa, we need to have our troops over there because there's Muslim warlords over there. And like, actually, the most celebrated warlord over there is a Christian, that Kony guy.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I follow the whole Kony thing. I just, you know, it seemed too fabricated.
Yeah, I think it was. I don't even know if Kony exists. But, I mean, Kony is a Christian in the sense that, you know, Adolf Hitler was a Catholic, probably.
Sure.
Yeah. So, yeah, man. Yeah. So, tell me about your book.
Sure. It's been out for a couple of weeks now. It's called Voluntary Islam. And it's essentially an anthology of all the articles I've written since 2009. I've kind of parsed out my favorites and put them in sort of an order I think makes sense. And I've improved on them, I think. Like, I went through and I fixed them up. And I think it's sort of like all of my best arguments. So now instead of like linking people back to old articles and things like that, I can just sort of say, that's in my book.
Oh, okay.
Plus, I picked up a lot of readers since I started that never followed a lot of my old stuff. So, like, a lot of the foundations that I've built the sort of work on, you know, a lot of them haven't been read yet. So, I just thought it was good to put them all in one place.
Who published the book?
Do you know Daryl W. Perry from Pre-Press Publications in New Hampshire?
Free Press or Pre-Press?
Sorry, Free Press Publications, yeah.
Yeah, he's the guy that edited one of the rap videos I did with Nima and took the cussing out of it and put it up on YouTube. And we were like, cool.
That's cool. He's a publisher.
I just thought it was funny for something called Free Press Publications to censor something. But we allow people to do remix. Are you laughing?
Yeah. No, you're right. But it's probably because of YouTube.
No, I think YouTube allows cussing. I think it was to get it out to more people was the point, which I can understand. I'm not against self-censoring, which basically this was because we put everything up Creative Commons, which, you know, who cares about copyright laws and everyone ignores them anyway, and we'd never sue anybody for violating them. But, you know, putting it up Creative Commons, attribution remix license basically says we're fine with y'all doing whatever you want with this. And he did. And, we're cool with it, man. It was just ironic to me to have something called Free Press Publication censor something, but I understand what he was doing, I think, which is trying to get it to more people and be able to like show it to children and say, check this out without their parents saying, what did you do?
Yeah, that makes some sense.
I don't know that he's showing it to children, but maybe showing it to adults who are sensitive to cussing. And the Freedom Fiends are getting on radio next month, like syndicated on GCN. And we've been practicing not cussing. It's hard, man. It's friggin' hard.
I don't swear. I'm sort of like Ben in that way.
Ben swears, just not on the radio, man. I talk to Ben about, you know, an hour a day, three or four times a week. I talked to him today. He swears once in a while.
Oh, yeah?
Just not on the radio.
I feel like the longer I go without swearing, the more weight it has when I choose to, if that makes sense.
It does. I mean, I use the F word like I use the word, you know, yeah, I use it like a filler. But Stefan Molyneux almost never cusses. In the interview I did with him on the Gumbo, at the end, he got really angry at the state and he started cussing really, really, really hard. And it kind of blew me away and it had a lot of weight because he almost never does it.
Right.
Yep. So you're turning into a good interview. I'm kind of talking over you a lot here because that's what I do. You know, Gumbo interviews are like 2/3 me and 1/3 the person. But you're doing immensely better. You get most improved interviewee award in the Liberty scene.
Do I get a like a peer review? Is there some? So, I mean, you're a hospital, right? Do I have a rap sheet?
A rap sheet?
Or what's it called? A profile? What do doctors have on their clipboards? Do you have a clipboard?
What do they have? They have like doodles that have nothing to do with their patients, man. That's just to look important.
Oh, okay. So you can't prescribe me anything for my interviews?
No, but you could actually make, you have that shinybadges.com site, right?
Yeah.
You could make some enamel shiny badges. You could make one for yourself that says Davey Barker, most improved Liberty guy, or most improved Liberty media guy.
All right.
And you could wear one, and you could sell them, and you could give them away.
I kind of want to make a state speeches hate speech pin.
I'd love it if you did. That was it was such an afterthought. It was like something Nima or I said in passing in a cast, and then I said, hey, that'd be a good name for this episode. And we named it that. And there's this guy named Krizzle who makes our cheap punk rock buttons. And,
yeah, I know Krizzle.
Yeah. And Krizzle's a lefty anarchist from Pacific Northwest, and he does amazing work, and he's really inexpensive. And, you know, I mean, they're not your buttons. They're not something you'll hand on to your grandchildren like your buttons. But for quick, cheap, easy merch, it is the best stuff in the world, Krizzle's buttons.
Yeah, absolutely. He's part of an agorist co-op that I'm part of. It's on Facebook. It's called Agorist Cross Promotions, and it's a closed group. All it means is it's different agorists that are shipping a physical product, and then we put each other's marketing collateral in our packages to promote.
Yeah, when I get stuff from him, like when I order a bunch of buttons from him, he always includes four or five buttons that are other designs. And I'm doing that with Ben Quaker, and he's doing that with me now. We each have some of each other's buttons, and when people order our buttons, we're throwing in one or two of the other guy's buttons.
Yeah, I've got a stack of your buttons that I'm putting in my shiny badges orders now.
Nice. Appreciate it. That's rock and roll, man. That's cool.
It's kind of like zines. We used to do that with zines, too.
Exactly.
That people used to have, like inserts. So, like, maybe I published my own zine, but I've got a little folded insert from this other zine.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember some zines that, like, actually had money that were more like magazines would occasionally put in a record, like a flexi disc. Do you remember flexi discs?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, for people who don't know, well, first of all, I think we should explain what records are. What were records?
Well, I don't quite know the technical specifications, but I mean, they were essentially just the best way they had to record sound at the time, and they were vinyl. And then
they were flat plastic discs that you put a needle on and they spun on a turntable.
Yeah.
And sound came out.
You know, back to the question of purity, there are still purists that insist upon using
Emperor's New Clothes, man. Emperor's New Clothes.
Do you like zombie movies?
What?
Do you like zombie movies?
Not really. I'm actually liking this zombie TV show from Canada because it's on Netflix called Todd and the Book of Pure Evil, though.
Okay. There's a zombie movie out right now called Warm Bodies that's essentially like Romeo and Juliet between like zombies and people. Like a girl and a zombie fall in love.
Well, I wonder how derivative it is of the trauma films. You know trauma films?
No.
They were kind of a low budget. They kind of kept independent filmmaking alive in the same way that like Maximum Rock and Roll kept punk rock alive until it could be what it is today, which is something sold in malls. Trauma films did a bunch of zombie and kind of like Living Undead and that genre of cheap slasher movies. The best known is The Toxic Avenger.
Okay.
I don't know if you've seen that, but they also did one called Tromeo and Juliet.
Okay.
Which was a Trauma Films treatment of Romeo and Juliet. And
did they do Lincoln versus Zombies?
It sounds like them, but maybe not. Let me look that up.
This was like piggybacking on the back of Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, like a simultaneous Lincoln zombie movie came out, and it was like a B film. The reason I brought up Warm Bodies is because the zombie in that movie is a vinyl purist. He likes his old records.
I'm a purist with using some old technology. I use tube preamps, and so does Nima. I'm speaking through one right now. And they sound a lot better to me, and they actually do, and they're a sound that you can't replicate yet with software. You can come close, but you can't do it. But vinyl, it does sound different than high-quality digital, than CDs. And vinyl and CDs both sound better than MP3s because MP3s are compressed format. They're a tenth of the file size and sound about a third or a half as good as uncompressed. They're just compressed because it gets them over the internet easier. But yeah, man, vinyl does not sound better than a well-made CD that's mastered well. It does sound slightly different. They say it sounds warmer. Basically, what that means is it lacks the total high end that digital can have. And you can actually replicate that with a CD by just adjusting a parametric equalizer's settings. There is, I believe, there is no better... vinyl at this point is not better than digital, and anyone who thinks it is suffering from Emperor's New Clothes. Do you know what Emperor's New Clothes is? You know that phrase?
Yeah, I know. I know the story. It means like
you can tell it so people will know.
It doesn't exist, right?
Yeah. Do you know? You want to tell the story? It's a really short story.
Yeah, I mean, it's essentially there's an emperor, and he's sort of gotten tired of all the newfangled stuff he's got, and so he wants the new best thing, and so he brings in this top level fashion designer, and the fashion designer decks him out naked and says, these are the most beautiful new clothes ever. And everyone around him lies to him and tells him that he's wearing the most beautiful clothes ever, even though he's walking around naked. And so he becomes deluded into thinking he's wearing the latest fashion, and then it takes a child to finally like poke through the authority and tell him he's naked.
Yeah, you know, that might be a good name for this episode, because I think that's a really good story that people used to tell when I was younger, and maybe when you were younger, and probably don't tell so much anymore. And I think it's a really good analogy for statism.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the Thales's laws, right? That the people around the authority figure can't tell the authority figure the truth. And so the authority figure is always stuck with these advisors that won't give him real information, and it prevents him from doing anything effectively.
Yeah, I mean, you know, on a less evil level, that happens at the corporate top level a lot, or in big business top level, which can be evil, but isn't implicitly, by definition, evil. I mean, corporations are, because they exist because of the government, but big business would exist in libpair, probably not like it does now. But I think that there are a lot of situations where companies have been ruined because the guy at the top or the lady at the top surround themselves with yes men rather than with people who will actually challenge them and agree to all the bad decisions they make.
Yeah.
But the same thing's being done to us with the state, because there's a whole lot of horizontal enforcement among people of people saying the emperor is clothed when he's naked. And emperor is a good term for that, because that's how they're behaving, you know, to where everybody says without the government, we wouldn't have roads. Without government, we'd all be drinking poison meat. And without the government, children would starve and work in brothels and coal mines, and grandma would die eating cat food. And what else would they do? There's a whole litany. You've heard them all, I'm sure.
Who would set the clocks back an hour?
Oh, Nima and I have a good phrase for that. Without the government, who would steal our time? We basically say that's the cron equivalent of tax withholding. They steal an hour from you and then give it back to you 6 months later without interest. I hate daylight savings time, man. It screws up my sleep schedule bad.
And there's no interest on that time. An hour months ago would have been more valuable to me. I was younger,
Yeah. It's like, yeah, they give the money back with tax withholding, and it's devalued by the time you get it, in addition to what they steal.
I think the important thing about the myth is that it's the child that blows the illusion, you know? And I think that is almost as powerful as the emperor itself in the story. And that is that the child is born and they're born honest. And so the propaganda doesn't work for them until they're indoctrinated, right? So there's always this risk in societies built on illusion that children will be born into it and blow the illusion for them.
Well, Nima and I are willing to be that child, because we've been called the Beavis and Butthead of Liberty. So I guess we are children. Let's take a little break here and come back and talk about Ben Stone for a half hour.
Okay.
All right.
You've read books, attended lectures, and you know the Constitution well enough to know it's a well-crafted blueprint to create an ever-increasing federal empire. But there's still one thing missing. Buttons! Freedom Fiends now has buttons. You'll get State Speech is Hate Speech, Anarchy Gumbo, Guns and Weed, and two designs for the Freedom Fiends. Wear them with pride. Use them to start conversations with statists. It's only $10 for 5 buttons, including shipping. Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says buttons.
Want to contribute to Liberty but short on cash? You can help the Freedom Fiends without even spending a post-1964 dime. Download uTorrent and start seeding Fiends episodes. Follow twitter.com/fiendtorrents to grab the past episodes and new ones as they post. Leave your computer on, seeding the torrents, while you're at work or asleep. The more people seeding the Fiends, the more drone-proof we'll be when the boot comes down. That's twitter.com/fiendtorrents.
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast, a tasty stew of freedom and fun. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's kittyfeet.com.
Welcome back to the rest of the Anarchy Gumbo interview with Dobby Barker. How are you doing, Dobby?
I'm good.
When your publisher contacted me and everyone else, which is what we do, to try to get you interviewed, he wrote me an interview and wrote me an email and asked me to interview you about your new book. And I remembered the first interview we did, and I didn't write him back.
Because I was that bad?
You were boring, man. You're boring, and you wouldn't talk about the subject we were supposed to talk about. Islam. And I'm actually having a lot more fun talking about punk rock and zombies and how dumb the state is, if that's cool with you. I mean, we can talk about Islam if you want, but people can read your book, right? Where can they get it?
FPP.cc is the publisher's website, and then you can just find it on Amazon if you search for Voluntary Islam.
Is it paperback or ebook or both?
Both.
Cool. Cool. Yeah, and I didn't write him back, and he never wrote me back a second time, follow up. But if he did, I was going to write back and say, I'm really interested in the book, but I want to have Will Coley come on and talk about it. But the other day I heard you on the Fajita Power Hour or whatever it's called. And I was like, I thought it was Will at first. Cause he was talking about the book. You were talking about the book. And I was like, this can't be Dobby, man. It's too captivating.
Well, that's good to hear. Yeah, when it comes to division of labor, Will and I work together at Muslims for Liberty, and he's typically the speaker and I'm typically the writer. And we used to joke that, like, I was the Jefferson to his Madison. But I've had to kind of jump in and get used to doing interviews, so I'm glad I'm doing better, I guess.
Yeah, and I can't take credit for it. Because I wasn't your first, and I didn't give you tips afterwards. I do take credit for the media blitz success. Partially, I take partial credit for that for the printable gun guy.
Yeah,
Cody. Yeah, because I wanted to interview him about 8 months ago when I heard what he was doing, and I contacted him, talked to him on the phone, and he's like, "I don't do interviews. I really don't want to do interviews, man. I just want the thing to speak for itself." And I'm like,
he's doing commercials, man. He's doing his own commercials.
For what?
For his printable gun project. Or his latest one is some sort of weird peer-to-peer file sharing.
Yeah. I talked to him. I talked to him for 2 hours. The first hour was convincing him why he needs to do interviews, and the second hour was convincing him, or was telling him how to do an interview. And then the third hour was interviewing him, and that was the first ever media appearance he did. And now he's like, you know, being flown out to speak in Germany at conventions, and he's on the New York Times, and you know, the members of Congress are trying to outlaw everything he does, and he's in the Wall Street Journal, and he's in Wired magazine, and I can take about 2% of the credit for that. I think I'm proud of that.
It's an offshore data haven is what he's working on, and I can't remember the name of it, but he's essentially trying to make it impossible for the feds to take 3D printed files off of the internet or ban them or block them, so that essentially it's like seeding a torrent, right? It's so that you can't delete the gun file.
Yeah, I don't know why he'd even need to have a physical offshore place to do that. I mean, WikiLeaks spread stuff they have some of that, but they also have, they do it all by BitTorrent. I mean, they, or they back it up by BitTorrent and then they just tweet it. And if their Twitter account gets deleted, they do another, they start another one and tweet it. And, that's kind of unstoppable. And the Freedom Fiends are sharing all of our episodes, including the Anarchy Gumbo ones like this. We will share this this way via BitTorrent with an RSS feed. And there's about 22 people that I know of. I can see how many people are doing it. Initial seeders who, every time an episode goes up, like within minutes, it's automatically downloaded and they're seeding it. And what that does is, like, literally right now, if the Fed goons came in and took me off to Gitmo or a FEMA camp or droned me and took our websites all offline, the Fiends Media would not stop. And as far as I know, we're the only Liberty people doing that.
It's ingrained in the internet forever.
Yeah, man. It is internet forever. Yep.
I think everything's going to be that way eventually. Like, I'm kind of waiting for the first social networking or social media site to be that way.
There's a couple that have tried it, but the thing is, when you don't do stuff with a central location, it works slower. It'd be really hard to do something that's immediate as Facebook, where you post something, it shows up, the page refreshes without refreshing it, and then the next person sees it immediately or within seconds because they have a huge databases that have to update. But they're pretty good at it for all the evil that Facebook has. And I've left Facebook. I'm not on there anymore. There's people on there posting in my stead, but I'm not on there. That's just a CIA mind control and data mining operation as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, you haven't gotten me to quit Facebook, but you have gotten me to admit that I'm an addict.
So yeah, well, I'll be your sponsor when you're ready to quit.
Okay.
If you want, you can call me in the middle of the night and say, Michael, I'm thinking of starting a new account. Talk me out of it. And I will, because I'm up in the middle of the night.
I'm thinking of starting a new page, actually. I was going to do it later today, but you interrupted me.
Yeah, that's not the answer to your addiction. That's like saying, well, I'm an alcoholic. I'm just going to do speed. Which I used to do and used to say, but, you know, I've been sober for decades. So, do you drink?
No.
No? You don't want to go get drunk with me afterwards?
No.
I'm kidding.
You're pretty far apart. I'm not sure if you know how this whole internet thing works.
Well, I think we could find a way to do it. You know, I could PayPal you or Bitcoin you enough money to buy a 12-pack, and then I could go buy one, and then we could turn on the webcams on Skype when you get back from the store and just get hammered together. I haven't had a drink since 1999.
And up on the bar with a webcam.
And you don't drink for religious reasons, right?
Yeah, mostly.
You didn't like it before that?
No, I drank quite a bit before I converted, so I kind of used it as an opportunity to give it up cold turkey.
So you were tending towards having a problem with it?
Yeah.
Oh, well, let's relapse right here on video, on cam, and we'll, no. My wife's in the other room protesting. Sorry, baby, I'm kidding. She was a cough of disbelief. Yeah. I like to interview people. This is going really well. I like to interview people on the Gumbo, because especially when they have something to pimp, like a book, because I don't do it like people do it, you know. And I like Ian contacted me and wanted me to interview Derek J about his new movie. Oh, by the way, I looked up now. Is the movie you were talking about Abraham Lincoln versus Zombies, or is that a spinoff?
I think that's the movie, yeah.
Okay. That's actually distributed by MVD Entertainment, which is my label. For they put out Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom, Hubert Selby Jr., It'll Be Better Tomorrow, DIY or Die, How to Survive as an Independent Artist, and they put out Derek J's movie. I got them a deal with that. So we're in good company.
So they're like a self-publishing DVD?
No, they're not self-publishing. They're a label. Like, you know, they don't take most things that are presented to them. And unlike self-publishing stuff, they don't charge you money if they decide to take something. It's like a record label, you know. If they decide to they don't give an advance, they do not give an advance. But if
so
they
label is a vote of confidence in your content,
right?
Daryl's the same way. I didn't pay to have my book published.
Yep. They're like that with DVDs, and they've been really good to me. I've been doing stuff with them since 2002, but they do
really well in the Redbox movie rental machines. Do you have those where you are?
Yeah. But, if they put my movies in the Redbox in Casper, Wyoming, that store would be picketed by Christians, and I'm not kidding, or Republicans. or both. And the same thing probably if they put Abraham Lincoln versus zombies in the red box. No, the stuff in the red box here is like, you know, romantic comedies with the cussing and the moderate flashes of sex edited out of them probably.
Okay.
Yeah, this is
I don't know if Walmart still does it, but do you remember in the 90s when all the albums that Walmart sold had all the swear words removed?
Yeah. Yeah, Nirvana got really upset about that.
Yeah.
But they were strong-armed by their label into doing it. So MVD is like a label, I guess is the way to say it. But so I sidetracked myself when I was talking about doing interviews. Usually when people have something out, they kind of do the media circuit. They do radio, they do TV, whether it's, you know, The Tonight Show or whether it's, you know, Free Talk Live and Anarchy Gumbo. And generally, it's kind of the same format. They have them on, although Free Talk Live varies from it too a little bit, and I like that. But generally, they have them on, they tell a couple jokes, they mention their new product, say where you can get it, tell an amusing story about how it came to be, and then the band plays them out. And I hate that, you know. And if you got something to promote, I just have you on and have you mention it in passing, and then we talk for an hour and people go, wow, this guy's really interesting and cool, and he's not just pimping his stuff. I want to see what his stuff is. It's all very calculated.
I'm more interested in the stuff I'm working on now. That's why I have zombies on the brain, is I'm trying to write a zombie novel.
Huh. Interesting. I think it's interesting from a, I wouldn't think you'd do that aspect, because people who are, this is my very narrow and probably wrong understanding of religious people, but people who are strongly religious that I have encountered in my life, which usually means Christians, have a problem with zombies because it's ungodly and it's, you know, the dead rising, and that's not something that's natural or good unless it's Jesus being risen from the dead by the Lord. But is there any Islamic prohibition or suggestion that you can think of against that?
Not that I know of. I mean, there's some apocalypse stuff that's sort of similar to the Bible, I guess. And so, I mean, the original zombie was supposed to be the book of Revelations and the dead rising from, because hell was full or whatever, right? But for me, zombies are a metaphor for democracy.
Well, Jesus is way before. Jesus is in the past, and the book of Revelations is in the future. And so Jesus is a zombie. I mean, that would piss off a lot of my neighbors, but I mean, he rose from the dead. That's what it says. So isn't he a zombie?
Well, that's the sort of famous atheist meme against Christianity. But Muslims actually don't think that Jesus died and was resurrected. So I would say no. But
a lot of people don't know that Muslims have a positive opinion of Jesus. And that would blow the minds of, like, my dad, who reads Sarah Palin's book and says it's the greatest thing he's ever said. Talk a little bit about the Muslim view of Jesus Christ. Or do they not say Christ, of Jesus?
They say Christ is a Greek.
It's an honorific, right?
And yeah, and so the word is Masih in Arabic, which is Messiah in Aramaic.
It's not his last name.
It's not his last name.
Yeah.
So essentially, Muslims accept Jesus as a prophet of God, as a prophet in the line of the biblical prophets. They don't use the birth narrative. The birth narrative in the Quran is very different from the biblical narrative, and they don't accept the death narrative. So the idea of death and resurrection and original sin and all that sort of like post hoc theology is not accepted. But as far as like the teachings of Jesus and who Jesus was, and it's sort of like it's accepting Jesus, but much more in line with what Judaism was. So it doesn't sort of become a new religion, but sort of a continuance of the original, if that makes sense.
Well, for the first few years, Christianity was a Jewish sect.
Yeah.
It wasn't its own thing. It was literally a type of Judaism. You know, I was just thinking the original sin idea, I've never liked that. I went to Sunday school as a little kid and was told that frequently and told later throughout my life going to a Christian boarding school. And I just realized why it bugs me. It's a social contract. You are with Original Sin, you are born into there's something wrong with you and there's only one way out of it.
Right. Yeah, that's an interesting way to put it, but you're right.
And I had a problem with social contracts from about the time I could speak and possibly earlier than that. Before I could form a complete sentence, my sister told me about having me strapped into a stroller when I was, you know, 1 and a half and could not form a complete sentence, but could sort of walk. And she was a teenager and stopped to talk to one of her teenage friends and didn't notice that I undid all three straps in this stroller and started running down the sidewalk in my diaper to try to, like, cause I wanted to be free.
Okay. My first encounter with the social contract was the Pledge of Allegiance, and I resisted from the first day. I said I wouldn't say it unless they would explain to me what it meant, and they wouldn't explain it to me, so I wouldn't say it.
Yeah, what I like to tell Constitution humpers is, and this is a fact, and that's a term we coined, and it's caught on, but it's caught on the wrong way. It's used by liberals to describe Tea Party people who get in the way of progress by using the Constitution. We mean it as anybody from either side of the aisle who thinks the Constitution grants rights. But, yeah, Constitution humpers, the thing I like to tell them when they're telling me why there should be... I mean, there's a guy I go shooting with here who's my state rep, allegedly. He's a buddy of mine who, like, actually tried to put in... I'm not really that much of a buddy with him anymore. I kind of lost him when I told him I thought he should put forth a bill that the Bill of Rights be taught in public schools here. It was my minarchist phase, you know, transition. And I was kind of like, well, if they're going to make these kids go to these government schools, at least they should learn the Bill of Rights because it's the rule of law and it sort of protects them a little bit, maybe. And he put that bill in, but then he expanded it to the U.S. Constitution, the Wyoming Constitution, and the Pledge of Allegiance must be said. And then he tried to pass a bill to ban gay marriage, and then he tried to pass a bill to ban Sharia law, which doesn't really exist in my state as far as I know. So, yeah. But, you know, when he was trying to make the kids say the Pledge of Allegiance, put that in law here, and they already say it in the school. He just wanted to put it in law so they couldn't not say it. I pointed out to him that the Pledge of Allegiance was created by a socialist agnostic who came up with it to sell flags because he was in the business of selling flags. You know that?
I thought he was a Christian socialist, but I'm sorry.
No, you're correct. And what I'm thinking of is it originally didn't have the under God in it. That was added later
that was to fight communism.
Right. Because it was basically saying, you know, God, it was just part of the state mythology and the church of the state and appropriating God to be the state, I think.
Yeah, it also wasn't originally the flag of the United States of America. It was originally my flag. But then when they started teaching it to immigrants, they were worried that immigrants would think that it was the flag of their home country. But they clarified.
And if you really want to get surreal and bizarre with it, instead of putting your hand on your heart, what did you originally do with your hand?
It was the Hitler salute.
Yep. But it was pre-Hitler.
It was, you know, the Nazi salute was born in America and then it immigrated to Germany. And,
is that a fact?
Popular among the National Socialists.
Is that a fact? I mean, I know that it was used here before it was used in Germany, but do you know that there's a direct delineate or,
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I forget his name, but the guy who was the flag salesman had a brother who was a utopian sort of National Socialist novelist, and his novels were translated into German and were very popular among the early National Socialists in Germany. And he popularized that salute because it was a return back to the old Roman, like, Caesar salute. And so that's the transmission of the idea, yeah.
So that was the Caesar salute, the hand
it was
raised.
Francis Bellamy was the flag salesman, and I forget his brother's name. But yeah, his brother was a novelist.
Wow, that's pretty awesome.
So yeah, Hitler wanted to be Caesar, and America wanted the flag apparently to be Caesar or something, I don't know.
He was an American socialist minister and author. He was not an agnostic. I was wrong on that. Abraham Lincoln was an agnostic. That's what I was thinking of.
Wow, that surprises me.
Or was he an atheist?
Well, you probably didn't say you were an atheist in public at the time.
Yeah. Yeah, every U.S. president has given lip service to God, including Obama. And, you know, everyone's all the right-wingers, a lot of them say, well, no, Obama's a Muslim. Obama's not a Muslim. He wouldn't kill as many Muslims.
He's not, he's a socialist. He's
his God is the state, and he wants to be the Pope of it and the King of it and the God of it. He's, you know, I mean, I hate to use the term because it's used by right-wingers, but it's kind of accurate. I think he's a secular humanist. Which sure. isn't necessarily a bad thing. I mean, being secular and being humanist aren't bad things, but together that basically is shorthand for you think the United Nations should control every aspect of our lives.
You know, I wish that the culture in America was such that these politicians who pretend to be Christians when they're not felt safe enough to come out and not have their atheism or whatever threaten their political careers.
Hmm. Well, yeah, but that's kind of the window dressing on the Titanic to me. That would be celebrated by the same people who say Obama is the best president ever because he lets women and gays go in the military and kill people who haven't done anything.
Yeah, I'm not saying that it's an important issue to me. I'm just saying that I would like that. I would like it if they were more honest with us about how they felt about things.
Before we get to the last like 5 or 10 minutes, and I would like to end with some redemption in the third act of talking about what are the important issues to you. I want to talk about our friend Ben Stone.
Sure.
And how cool he is. I think Ben Stone needs to have a radio show. I can't believe the Freedom Fiends are getting it before him. But, you know, it's kind of like McDonald's doesn't make the best burger, but they're the pushiest. And that's how the Freedom Fiends are compared to Ben Stone. You know, Ben Stone is the fine steak in the restaurant. The out of the way place that you have to find and wait in line for, and the Freedom Fiends are the McDonald's.
Okay.
So I think Ben Stone invented an aspect of libertarian theory that he's not getting credited for. And I think it's spreading like wildfire. And as far as I can tell, he invented this. If I'm wrong, it doesn't diminish him at all because he's still amazing. But let me ask you about this. He was the first person I heard to talk about the difference between the state and the government and say that the government is all the buildings and the salaries and the badges and the cops and the bureaucrats and the piles of papers that are the laws and the infrastructure of it. Whereas the state is the collective hallucination that everyone has that keeps it going. The only other person I've seen come close is Larkin Rose, where he talks about if everybody quit paying taxes all at once, the state would dissolve. And he's saying the state is different from the government, but he's still not quite getting it to the degree that Ben is. Do you think that that's possible that Ben came up with that idea?
I've heard Stefan Molyneux say something similar when he talks about the farm, but he's never as explicit as Ben Stone is when it comes to that distinction.
And he said it after Ben did. And I don't even know if he got it from Ben or came up with it independently or probably more likely heard it from a friend who heard it from a friend who heard it from a friend and thought he came up with it. Or maybe not, but.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because like, that's essentially like Ben's definitions of government and state. That's not like you could look that up in a book and find it anywhere. So it's sort of like he's reclaiming the words. But I think it's a really interesting and accurate distinction because it's totally true. If the government declared bankruptcy and disappeared tomorrow, 90% of the population would be looking around for another government. Like,
yeah.
The virus would survive in their minds.
Yeah. Right? Whereas, and conversely, if the state ceased to exist, if everybody or a huge majority of people just finally said, I don't recognize your authority. If a few people do that, they end up in prison. But if 98% or even like, I think 65 or 70% of the people did that.
I think you've given 20%. The government too much credit.
Okay, you're right. If enough people stopped believing in it and giving it the power that feeds it, the state would cease to exist, but the government would live on for 2 or 3 or 4 weeks until the paycheck stopped coming.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I haven't talked with Ben about this, but I've been thinking about it is if the state ceased to exist by Ben's definition, what is the harm in the government continuing to exist? Like what behavior or what form does the infrastructure take if the state ceases to exist?
Well, let's see. I mean, people would still go to work for a while, but even before the paycheck stopped, like for instance, a lot of mailmen would probably stop going to work or doing a very good job with it, or they'd just throw the mail in a dumpster. Whereas I think about, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, I think people had pride in their work, whether it was government work or not, and yeah. would probably, you know, I don't think there are many mailmen out there who still believe the rain, sleet, snow, or night of day, or Saturday, because they're not even doing it on Saturday anymore. You know, I've thought about soldiers. Like the problem with America trying to, one of the many problems with America trying to fight battles in the Middle East or anywhere where they're fighting people on their home turf. Mm-hmm. The people who are they're fighting on their home turf aren't necessarily even drawing a paycheck and maybe starving and giving up everything they have to fight for their home turf, religion, nation, beliefs, or the desire to leave me the F alone, like one of those things, or their family or whatever. Whereas American soldiers over there, or any professional soldier body, you know, standing army, if the paycheck stopped coming and America said, okay, we got a plane, we're going to be leaving, y'all can go home now, it's all over. I think about 95% of them would go back, and about 5% of them would probably stay and fight. And I think about 3 or 4 weeks later, if they came with another plane and said, all right, we got another plane going back to America, you can jump on it. You've been working for a month now without a paycheck and you're starving and you're, you know, shooting rats to survive like the guys you're fighting, or goats or whatever. I think most of them would be on that plane home.
Sure. I mean, I think most of them don't want to be there in the first place.
At this point. Yeah.
I mean, they call it the poverty draft, right? There are people who, for whatever like economic reasons, that's their best deal. And they go into it sort of ignorant of what they're getting into, and they're sort of lied to by recruiters. But if they had a choice, I'm sure they would much rather be, you know, doing computer programming for a company instead of the military, or doing, you know, mechanic, whatever it is that they're doing, even if it was like private security or police work or anything. I'm sure they would rather be doing it here.
I actually know a guy in the Army who's in it exactly because of that. You know, it's not a patriotism thing. It's not a let's fight back thing. It's a job, you know, with the economy wrecked to the point where it's the best job available with their training. And he's a Freedom Fiends fan. And I said to it, you know, he was like, yeah, I play it in the barracks. And I'm like, man, maybe you shouldn't play that out loud. You might get in trouble. And he's like, I play it out loud, and most of the people here really dig it. They feel the way I do.
Wow.
Yeah. So the difference between the state and the government. I just wanted to shout out and put on record that I think Ben invented that concept, and I think it's great, and I think it's a really important next step in liberty to teach that to as many people as possible, because I think it's another step towards libpair. Because when people are fighting the government, and I'm not using the word fighting in a violent sense, I'm using it in an ideological sense.
Sure.
Or even if you're like, let's starve the government, let's not pay taxes. And I pay taxes, you know, and then complain nonstop about it. But I don't want to get thrown in a cage for that or lose what my wife and I have. So I reluctantly pay it. We got our $15 refund today. It keeps going down each year. Next year we'll owe six cents probably. So I really think it's important to teach the children well and teach as many people as possible that idea of the state is different from the government. Because if you're fighting the government, if it goes away, like you said, there's going to be a vacuum to fill it with another state, with another government of some sort. I mean, that would absolutely happen in my state of Wyoming. Everyone here, I think more people in Wyoming hate the federal government per capita than any other state. But if the federal government disappeared tomorrow, all the politicians here would say, okay, now we're the state of Wyoming and we're going to tell you what to do. And I think a lot of people would look toward that. Even the people who curse the federal government nonstop would be like, all right, what's going to take its place? I guess it's the state of Wyoming would be my guess.
Yeah. But I think there's a risk in what Ben is saying, because I think that it can be interpreted as a way of rescuing government from anti-statism. Like, if you were a statist and you heard that distinction made, it's almost like an opportunity to hold on to the government while thinking you're letting go of the state. So I feel like the language could easily be corrupted and misused, if that makes sense.
Well, that didn't cross my mind, but it absolutely could, and any language could be corrupted, but everything of liberty already has been. I mean, I would say there are more people in America who, if you ask them to name a libertarian, would say Glenn Beck than anyone else.
Yeah.
Or would say, they wouldn't even say Ron Paul. They'd probably say, you know, some like Sarah Palin. Those people get called libertarian. That horrible leftist statist guy who does that talk show where he brings the gray-haired, distinguished-looking 50-year-old gentleman, what's his name? Bill Maher is listed on Wikipedia as American American libertarian.
Yeah, because he identifies as a libertarian.
Yeah.
On his show, he says, well, you know, I'm a libertarian.
Yeah.
Except for all these parts where I'm socialist.
Him and Glenn Beck are the opposite ends of the spectrum away from libertarian.
We ought to set them up. Bill Maher and Glenn Beck should get married.
Or, you know, go on each other's shows and scream. I'd make popcorn to see that. Let's take a little break and then come back for 10 or 15 minutes more. This is going well. We're already at an hour, and I committed to a half hour, and then this is just going so well. You got 10 or 15 more minutes?
Yeah, sure.
All right.
Did your world collapse when Ron Paul didn't win? Don't keep hoping for some great man to fix government through government. Complete your evolution today to full-on anarcho-capitalist. Reward your brain with the freedom fiends and quit breaking your heart with some politician. While the libertarians argue,
but who would build the roads?
The Freedom Fiends have already built the roads and moved on to making the great media content of the libertarian paradise. FreedomFiends.com. That's FreedomFiends.com. Since time began, tyrants have taken aim at personal liberties. Now there's a movie that aims back.
The government has no more right to tell us what to put in our bodies than they have to take our guns or tell us what books we can read.
Six drug police were eaten by bears while raiding a marijuana farm.
On your knees, you dirty hippies!
Jesus.
On your knees!
What's the problem, officer?
Today, many cops who enforce pot laws do so only because it provides them with cushy jobs, good benefits, and a chance to push people around.
I was an undercover narcotics officer. The drug war is nothing but a farce.
The Second Amendment says you gotta keep you and your gat intact.
Guns and Weed, the Road to Freedom. A film by Michael W. Dean and Nima Vadavi.
DVD available now at gunsandweed.com or on Amazon. That's gunsandweed.com. Makes the perfect gift. Remember, that's gunsandweed.com.
Are you one of the 12% of Americans who still approves of our government? Then we need your help to force the other 88% into compliance. When you're not busy spying on your neighbors or squinting at everyone, tell anyone who will listen why more government is a good thing. You'll get a warm and fuzzy feeling demanding more taxes and arguing in favor of gun control while militarizing our police, because folks just aren't smart enough to handle real freedom.
That is so square. Check out the additional Freedom Fiend show, Freedom Fiends Live, every Sunday on the LRN.FM streaming feed or satellite radio.
Broadcasting live and worldwide from a windowless bunker inside a mountain near an undisclosed location in the rural Wild West of the occupied states of America.
Freedom Fiends Live expands on the Fiends' weekly Wednesday podcasts, but now we're kicking the hornet's nest live. Talk back to the back talkers every Sunday from 5 to 7 p.m. East Coast time. From the makers of Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom, Freedom Fiends Live. Call in soon before we get droned.
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. That proves you're smarter than most people.
So, Anarchy Gumbo Podcast interview with Davi Barker, the Muslim agorist. Welcome back. How you doing, Davi?
I'm good. I've got another rule for the teaching hospital.
All right. What is it?
Before you begin recording, restrain your cat.
Oh, did you see my... That's a good one. Did you see my blog post on how to keep cats off your electronic gear?
No, but if there's a way, I'll pay money.
It costs $8 to do it, and I will send you the blog post.
Okay, what is it?
Go to creamyradioaudio.com, and it's the top blog post. It probably won't be when this comes out, but it is now.
I'll check it out when we're done.
All right. So the redemption in the third act. What's next for Davey Barker? And then what is important to you? You talked about like what's important to you, but didn't say what it was. And I cut you off as usual. So first of all, what's next for Davey Barker?
I don't know if you got this news, but I recently left my full-time job and I'm now working at home full-time as a writer and graphic designer.
That's awesome. I really like the Freedom Fiends silver dime cards you designed, by the way, or helped with.
Yeah? Yep. Cool.
Yes. I gave one to my dad and he's afraid of Muslims and it says Muslim agorist design on the back. So that was fun.
That's cool. Yeah. That's a big part of my work and he deserves a plug. Drew Phillips from Don't Tread on Meme does a lot of really great work. He's doing the silver dime cards and he's real bullish on Bitcoin and we're doing some other kind of product development. So that's exciting.
Cool.
I'm trying to write more books, but I'm kind of sick of nonfiction, so I'm going to start trying to write fiction. You know, you said something. You said when you finished your first documentary, everyone came to you and said you had to make another documentary, and you said, nah, I don't feel like it.
Yeah.
I'm the same way. I did my first gallery show, and then I'm like, I'm kind of over gallery shows. And now I've kind of done my first, like, nonfiction book, and I'm kind of like, I need to move on to something else. And, I don't think that that's a bad thing. I think people get typecast too easily and that keeps them from being innovative.
I think it's a really good thing personally. I mean, if someone wants to build a career as an artist of a certain type, more power to them. And that is kind of how you become a rock star at doing something. But I've always kind of had ADD kind of behavior ever since I was a little kid. And thank God I was, born before they were giving kids speed for that. I missed that by about 5 years. I'm 48 and they started dosing kids with Ritalin, about 5 years after I was 5 years old.
My brother got Ritalin and as soon as he was old enough to figure out how bad it was for him, he got off of it. And I avoided the diagnosis by kind of keeping it to myself. And so I never got the prescription, but I definitely had the symptoms.
I can't count the number of people I met in NA meetings who in their share said the first drugs they ever took that they really enjoyed and made them want more was the Ritalin they were given in high school or grade school.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So go ahead.
What's important to me? I think the peaceful parenting part of the movement is really interesting to me, really important. Anything involving children, I think is a really important part of the Liberty mission, right?
Yes.
So that's what I'm interested in. Both, I'm working on two novels. One is a zombie book and one is an alien book. And so it's kind of a race to the finish line and I'm aiming for young adult fiction. And it's for that reason.
Cool. Do you have kids?
No, just the cat. We're kind of talking about kids soon though.
Cool. What's your wife do for work?
She's a civil rights attorney.
Ooh, cool. That is interesting.
Pretty awesome, actually. She does some FBI cases. She does some she works for the Council on American Islamic Relations.
Like she sues the government, you mean?
Yeah.
Nice.
There's a pretty high profile case. It actually went all the way to the Supreme Court, or at least a class of them went to the Supreme Court, where the FBI had put a GPS tracking device on a guy in our community's car. And so when he found it, he brought it to her, and she was the attorney that sued the FBI over it.
Oh, I heard about this. This was written up in, like, Wired magazine and stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
He posted a photo on, like, he sent the photo to Wired, and Wired identified the piece of equipment.
It was like a brick. It was huge, man.
Yeah, it looked like a pipe bomb, actually. Like, it had caps at both ends and a, like, electrical device wired to it. Like, if I had found it, I would have thought it was a pipe bomb. But, that was a battery pack, apparently. And the really interesting thing about it was that the case that actually went to the Supreme Court was a drug case. It was a marijuana case. And so you had all of these Muslims following the Muslim case and all of these, like, marijuana legalization activists following the marijuana case. And suddenly they had to agree that they had a common cause.
What was the Muslim aspect? Was he Muslim?
Yeah, he was Muslim, and he was being tracked because his father was in Egypt and was, like, loosely connected to some people in the Arab Spring.
Hmm.
And the marijuana case was just that the guy was – he had a grow operation, and they used the car to connect him to the grow operation. And it's funny, the Supreme Court ruled in their favor. They said that the FBI couldn't do that. But, you know, now they just, you know, track us with drones or whatever, so.
Cool. I mean, not cool, but cool that she does that. My wife's a paralegal, but not things as interesting as taking security, personal privacy cases to the Supreme Court. Not that she wouldn't love to, but, you know, it's what she does. And there's not a lot of that in Wyoming.
Right. There's, well, what she did was she wrote what's called an amicus brief, which
is
a friend of the court. And so she essentially wrote a letter explaining that her case was relevant to the case before the Supreme Court and that she had something to say about it, basically. But it was the pot case that was before the Supreme Court, not the Muslim case.
Well, I think we're at the end of our time here. Do you want to tell people all your websites and where to find your things?
Yeah, the easiest place to go is davibarker.com, which is also muslimagorist.com, which is also shinybadges.com. And on the left-hand column, there's all the other projects that I'm involved in. Silver Circle, Don't Tread on Me, Muslims for Liberty. There's probably a dozen others. I don't know what they all are anymore.
Yeah. At some point, I said I was going to stop registering a new domain for everything that I did and just put it all on michaelwdean.com. And I did that for a while and got rid of, you know, let some sites expire and then just got back to it. It's an addiction, man. I'm back up to like, I had like 30 domains at one point. I got down to 4 and now I'm back up to like 9.
You know, the way I do it is muslimagorist.com is the actual URL. And then I just keep grabbing other URL names and directing them to the parts of that site that they refer to. So shinybadges.com goes to the store section of my website. davibarker.com goes to the graphic design part of my website.
That's a smart way to do it, but that wouldn't solve the addiction that I'm talking about having.
Okay.
The addiction I have is registering domain names and having to pay for them.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I mean, it's not taking food off my table, but it's like, oh, God, I was spending $300 a year on just registrations at one point.
Okay. Well, you ended up with Kitty Feet. That's pretty unique.
Actually, kittyfeet.com, the site for this podcast, Anarchy Gumbo, was the first domain I registered in 1996. I've had that one forever. And it used to be kind of my personal blog before there was blogging software. I would literally like, you know, download the HTML file, add text and pictures to it, and then re-upload it to add. And it would push down the page like a blog does when I added new stuff. But but the site also became really sprawling to where like there were literally 1,100 pages on it and no central way, no sitemap and no sense of it. Someone actually called it the Winchester Mystery House of the internet. Do you know what that is?
Yeah, I live right near the Winchester Mystery House.
Yeah. It was like a website that I just kept building on and adding doorways that went nowhere. That's,
you know, I wish there was more of that on the internet. I feel like there's so many tools for redirecting people around. I wish there were more mazes and less maps.
It was art. Not just because of the content, but also the structure of it. And I would do things where, like, I would have the period in a sentence be a hyperlink. And not, you know, and it would be colored different, but people wouldn't necessarily get it, and some would. And it would go off to something else where there'd be an image map, which was an old way of doing links, where you'd have a picture and different portions on it went to different things. And I had a lot of fun with it, but I was about to let it lapse about 2 years ago, a year and a half ago. And then I decided one night while talking to Ben Stone on the phone at about 4 a.m, you know, hey, I should start a podcast as just interviews, because we were doing a few interviews on the Freedom Fiends, but it kind of got in the way of the flow of the consistency of Nima and I just yakking back and forth. So I decided to start another one, and I do most of them, but Nima occasionally does an interview on the Gumbo. And it's kind of our repository for interviews. And it's become kind of popular on its own, not as much as Freedom Fiends, but it's kind of fun. And I was like, I almost registered anarchygumbo.com. And I was like, wait, I have this other one. Who says the name of the URL has to be the same as the name of the project? And just immediately deleted everything on it and turned it in, you know, uploaded WordPress and started from there that night and interviewed Ben, you know, between 4 and 5 a.m. and then built the site from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. and then went live with it.
Cool.
So cool, man. What are you going to do the rest of this week and today that's fun to hear about?
What am I doing? Well, we've got really the biggest thing is Silver Circle Movies premieres in about 9 days.
Awesome.
So the first screening in New York is going to be on the 22nd. And so right now it's a big push to, like, you know, get the activists together for sine waves at the Fed building and get some of the, like, bloggers and writers their press passes. And, you know, it's kind of an exciting time in the release of the movie.
Where is the premiere and what's the date and time and how can people get tickets?
You want to go to silvercirclemovie.com and it's going to be at a place called the Village Cinema in New York, and it starts on the 22nd and it goes to the 28th. There's 4 shows a night, 1, 3, 7, and 9.
You're involved with that movie, right?
Yeah, I'm one of their marketing people. I'm one of the bloggers on their site. I do a lot of their graphic design.
Well, you know, as a filmmaker, I'll tell you, it's pretty important to, do you guys have an IMDb page?
I think so.
Okay.
Find
out who's in charge of the IMDb page. And if they haven't done this yet, go on there and have them edit it to add the premiere. That's really important on IMDb. And a New York City premiere looks really good on a movie. So make sure they do that.
Okay.
Cool, man.
It looks like there is one, but yeah. I'll see what we can do to sort of.
Is there a premiere listed?
Where would it be listed?
What's the release date that it has listed? Or does it say in production?
March 22nd, 2013. It's there.
Oh, and they have that it's a New York premiere?
No, it doesn't look like it.
Okay. Have them update that and put the place it's premiering. That's important.
Okay.
That's all I got, man. It's been really good yakking with you. And thanks for coming on the Gumbo. We should do it again sometime.
Yeah, whenever you want.
Cool, man. Worms.
Talk to you later.
Thank you for listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's KittyFeet.com.
Anarchy Gumbo is proudly syndicated by Alterati.com and the Liberty Radio Network.
All with a rotating guest on a spit, barbecued for your pleasure.
Outtakes, yay.